Welcome to Two Way Street. My guest today is Broadway actress and singer Terry Burrell. She's about to open in a one-woman show that she also wrote about Ethel Waters, one of the first black entertainers to make an impact among white audiences. During the course of our conversation, Terry relates a story about the friend who encouraged her to keep working on her show because the friend feared that Ethel Waters was in danger of being forgotten. And so Burrell did keep working. Her show, Ethel, is about to open at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta. It's probably true that many people today don't know who Ethel Waters was. But if you'd been a lover of the blues in around 1919, you probably would have seen her on a bill with Bessie Smith when they played clubs in Atlanta. If you'd been a patron of the Cotton Club in Harlem in the 1920s, you would have celebrated Ethel as one of the great black singing stars of her day. If you'd seen the Broadway production of Irving Berlin's As Thousands Cheer in 1933, you would have seen her as she became the first black woman in an otherwise all-white Broadway show. Ethel Waters was a star of Hollywood movies and was nominated for an Oscar for her supporting role in a picture called Pinky, which starred Jean Crane and Ethel Barrymore. And Waters was the first black woman to have a lead role in a network TV series. It was called Beulah, but Waters quit the show when she told ABC Television the scripts were demeaning to African Americans. Waters closed her long career by singing gospel music as a star of the Billy Graham Crusades. This is the first stage play that Terry Burrell has written, but she's had a long career as a singer and actress on Broadway and in regional theaters around the country. Her Broadway credits include featured roles in Dreamgirls, Into the Woods, Thoroughly Modern Millie, Showboat, and Three Penny Opera, among other shows. Terry Burrell, what a real pleasure to have you here for Two Way Street. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for asking me to come in.
Yeah. Ethel.
Yes.
The story of Ethel Waters. Mm-hmm. Let's start, if we can, by talking about why Ethel Waters is worthy of an evening of theater. She had a truly remarkable and at times very difficult life, didn't she?
Actually, when you are introduced to Ethel in this piece, it is at one of those difficult times. She's now middle-aged, in her early 50s, and her career has tanked. She's had an amazing career as a recording artist for Columbia Records, 10 years. She's done film, she's been to Europe, big star in Europe, and now nothing. She owes the government $25,000. She's had to leave L.A., and she's come back to Harlem, and she's renting an apartment from her niece, trying to jumpstart her career all over again. And, you know, I think of her really more as a character in this piece. And she says, I wish I could make you understand what this feels like.
First of all, she was the product of a rape. Right?
Yes.
Her mother was raped at knife point, I believe.
Her mother was almost 13, was 13 when she had Ethel. Her father was drunk. Her mother's ambition was to be an evangelist and spent her time at church. She was the good girl. She also shared the house with two half-sisters who were terrible alcoholics. Mm. The grandmother was the only support for the family, and she never made much money, maybe $4 or $5 a week, and she supported the entire family. When Ethel was born, it was such a traumatic thing for her young mother that she rejected her. Mm-hmm. And because of the difficulty of the circumstances, you know, this was not a child who was ever hugged, ever kissed, ever told, I love you. Ethel was 52 years old before her mother ever said to her, you're a good daughter.
She left home at 12, 13 years old, and actually was married at that young age, right?
She married at 13, and her husband was 23 years old and used to physically abuse her. And in the show, she does get her revenge, but you'll have to come and see it to see how that happens.
So she She was, by the way, we should say she grew up in, or she was born in Chester, Pennsylvania,
which was a difficult area and remains so even to this day. And, you know, it was not a strictly African-American community. There were all kinds of people there. And they were all poor. That was the thing that they had in common.
Yeah. She went to work when she was 13 as a chambermaid in a Philadelphia hotel.
She did.
And I'm not quite sure how she found her way to a local nightclub in Philadelphia, but she was at a nightclub, right?
She turned 17 and was at this popular teenage hangout. And her nickname, her friends just called her Chippy. And they loved the way she sang, and they kept urging her to enter this talent contest, Rat Skills, that was the name of it. So she enters the contest, and she won the contest. And Braxton and Nugent were there, and they were this very popular Negro vaudeville act at the time. In those days, they didn't say African-American or Black American. It was Negro and colored.
Mm-hmm.
And she went on tour with them. And she worked really, really hard until one night she overheard them having a conversation and realized they had been cheating her out of her money. Mm. Or as she puts it, cheat me out my Black money. The club had been paying them $25 for her act, and all they gave her was 10. Now, at the time, she wasn't sure what was going to happen when she went on the road. The job she had as a chambermaid at this hotel, she got through her mother, her biological mother, Louise. So she asked her mother to please hold on to my position and keep it open for me just in case this doesn't work out. And when she was working as a chambermaid, she would finish her work really, really fast. She'd lock the door, and she'd grab, like, a brush and stand in front of the mirror and practice singing and performing.
Wow. She went out on the Black vaudeville circuit.
Yes, she did.
What was that all about? What was that circuit like? I mean, it is what I assume it's called, but do you know much about that experience?
It was called the TOBA, Theater Owners Booking Association. But the conditions in those theaters were so bad that the performers at the time nicknamed it Tough on Black Asses.
Oh.
And she, in the show, she talks about some of those experiences where in Cleveland, if she wanted to get on the stage, she had to climb up a ladder through the orchestra pit and jump. She talks about the rats that would be in the alleys in the theaters in Detroit. She said, they were so big, first time I saw one, I thought they was puppies. You know, theater owners who tried to cheat her, one of them tried to pay her off in pennies. You know, and she counted every single one of them and made him pay her the $10 he was trying to jip her out of.
Was she a blues singer in those days? What was she singing?
Now, here's the significance of Ethel. Ethel came around the time when you had these big gut bucket kind of singers like Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith.
Yeah.
And she sang the blues, but she didn't have that kind of a voice. Her voice was softer, more refined. So it wasn't until she started singing at Edmund's Cellar in Harlem. Mr. Edmonds couldn't stand the way she sang the blues. Now, the people in the club loved it, but he couldn't stand it. And he would start razzing her about it. Well, one night he had to fire the house pianist because he couldn't play music and hired this guy named Lou Henley. And Lou Henley said to her, why are you trying to sing like that? It doesn't suit your voice. Don't you listen to people like Rudy Valley?
They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead.
You know, Fanny Bryce.
For me a lot, but there's one thing that I've got. It's my man.
Now, that's the quality that suits your voice. And so she started to sing the music that those white singers at the time made popular. And the way I describe her, not in the show, of course, but she's like the Diana Ross of her day. Mm-hmm. You know, when Diana Ross came around, it was a completely different kind of voice. You still knew it was somebody Black who was singing, but she sang it in a way that made it accessible to all kinds of people. So once she started singing like that, white folks who lived downtown started hearing about this Black singer.
There's a story, and perhaps in your research you could tell me whether you're aware of this and whether it's true. There's a story that she came to Atlanta at one point, mm-hmm. and played a date. She was on a bill with Bessie Smith. Is that right?
There's a couple of times when she played in Atlanta, and there was a couple of very significant stories. But yes, she played on a bill with Bessie Smith. I don't remember what city. Bessie had it in her contract that no other singer could sing the blues.
That's a story.
Ethel was her opening act. All the people in the club started chanting for Ethel to sing the blues. So the club owner just overrode the contract and had Ethel sing the blues. And she stared clear of Bessie. I mean, these women were tough and they did not play, okay? And Bessie Smith, the story goes, called her over one night and said, "Come here, long, tall goody." She said, "I ain't never had anybody do that to me on my own territory." She said, "You know you can't sing the blues worth a sh."
All right. So Ethel Waters starts appealing to white audiences in the 20s, probably?
Probably 20s, 30s or so, yes.
What was she singing?
She was singing things like Dinah.
Dinah?
Carolina gave me Dinah.
I'm the proudest one beneath the Dixie sun.
That kind of thing. You know? She actually wrote composer W.C. Handy to sing St. Louis Blues. I hate to see that evening sun go down.
That evening sun go down. Lord, I hate to see that evening sun go down.
It's very accessible.
Yeah.
You see? She started singing, "Old Man Harlem, give me Sunday headache." And then, much later on in her career, you had composers like Harold Arlen, who wrote Stormy Weather. I just got the license to use it. And you had Irving Berlin writing for her.
Harold Arlen
yes.
wrote Stormy Weather. Here's one of the great composers of his time
yes.
writing for a black performer. That in itself, I suppose, is pretty remarkable at the time. Yeah,
she was the first to record Stormy Weather.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of her singing that song.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather.
I wish that our listeners could see that Terry Burrell, that was Ethel Waters singing Stormy Weather, but in the studio here, Terry Burrell just was Ethel Waters lip-syncing.
You know how long I've been listening to this
and
woman?
Performing. So she became, and we're not going to tell her entire life story, but the point is she became one of the great crossover artists
yes,
of
that's
her
exactly
day.
What she became.
She
the first.
Right. She was like the first. Is she the first black star in a mixed show on Broadway? Is that something like that?
Yes. Harold Arlen brought Irving Berlin to the Cotton Club. This is in the 30s, to hear Ethel Waters. And Irving Berlin invited her to come in and audition for a show he had written called As Thousands Cheer. Mm-hmm. And she got the part. And she was the only black person in the show. And there was a little controversy because they wrote Heat Wave for her. That's when she first performed it. Heat Wave, not Marilyn Monroe, but Ethel Waters.
We're having a heat wave.
Having a heat wave.
A tropical,
heat
wave. Yeah. I didn't realize
yes,
that.
Yes, that's right. And he wrote a dirge. And this was really taking a chance called Supper Time. And it was about a lynching. When Ethel would come out to take her bow, she would get this standing ovation that went on for minutes at a time. Well, Irving Berlin got a letter, and the letter demanded that she not be allowed to take her bows with the rest of the cast, and the letter was from her white castmates. And Irving Berlin said to them, "Okay, fine. We'll take all the bows out altogether."
Wow.
Wow was right. She, at that time, became the highest paid performer, colored or white, on the Great White Way. We're talking about, this is in the 30s, and she had to be making something like $5,000 a week.
Do you know what year that would have been by any chance?
I think it was in 1933.
Okay, okay. That's a remarkable story. And then she became a movie star.
Yes. The big movie was Cabin in the Sky.
What is Cabin in the Sky? It is an iconic movie of the 30s, I think. And why is it such a famous picture today?
I don't know. Maybe the nostalgia attached to it. You know, it was also Lena Horne's debut. It was also, in an odd way, almost the beginning of the end for Ethel's career, because she hated Lena Horne.
Really?
She hated her. She despised her. And Lena was not very good at that time. You know, she was beautiful. And when she was on the set, there was all this fussing and, you know, carrying on over her. And I think Ethel felt like she was not getting the attention and the respect that she should have been getting. One day, Lena twisted her ankle on the set, and everybody ran over to pick her up, and Ethel said something nasty. And everybody had a negative reaction to it. And the story I read in one of the many books I've read about her was that she really lost it. She was a tough lady and a complex individual. She lost it and went off and cussed people out and told people off. And Hollywood just, I don't know if they blacklisted her or if the powers that be just said, we don't need this.
And am I right? Let me make sure I've got this right, because you said when we started that you pick up the story when she is really down on her luck.
Oh yes,
she's lost everything and trying to make a comeback. And was it sometime after Cabin in the Sky that happened?
Oh yes.
Why did you decide to pick up her life there?
Because it was such a prolific career. Where do you start? And I thought, well, why not start in the middle of everything? Mm-hmm. I can use that device to sort of talk about what was in the past. Let's live a little bit in the present. Because what she's basically doing in this piece is she's telling her stories. And she says, look, I just spend my days singing my old songs, telling stories as they come to me. They don't come in no particular order. That's memory be like that, right? So she goes back and forth. I don't take her too far. I don't take her too far. For instance, I foreshadow Billy Graham, but I don't take her as far as Billy Graham, because that's about 10 years in the future from where we are.
We should point out that that's what happened to her career. She became a gospel singer who went out with the Billy Graham Crusades, right?
Yes, she did. His Eye Is on the Sparrow.
His Eye Is
on the
Sparrow.
That was her grandmother's favorite hymn.
How does that song go?
Why do I feel discouraged? Why do the shadows come? Why should my heart feel lonely and long for heaven and home?
Wow.
It was the song she sang to her grandmother as she watched her dying on some broken-down sofa.
What I think is remarkable, of course, I haven't seen your show yet, but you talk about the fact that she lived she was tough. She looks grandmotherly. She looks like the sweet old lady later in her career in movies. But as you point out, she was tough.
She had to be.
She grew up rough, in a rough world. And yet, the song that her career becomes known for later on, yes, is this gorgeous gospel song.
Yes. Yes, she had tremendous faith. And I think that's the thing that sustained her in her difficult moments. And yes, she was tough, but she could also be very loving. I mean, this woman supported an entire convent of nuns.
Really?
Because when she was about 12, 13 years old, no, maybe a little younger than that, you know, she would live with her mother sometimes, Louise, but most of the time she lived with her grandmother, who she called Moms. And sometimes Louise and Moms would get into it. And, you know, so Louise sent her to a Catholic school once just to tweak mom's nose, but it was the first time that anybody had ever showed this child any respect and any love, and she never forgot it. You know, she was extremely poor. I can't even begin to describe that she lived in a one-room shack that she shared with her two aunts. We're talking about a space that had roaches, rats, holes in it, chiggers, which we call bed bugs today. Mm-hmm. She said that sometimes just to get a little peace, she would just sleep on a old ironing board or out in the street with the other kids. This was a child who was around prostitutes and gamblers, but she didn't judge these people in a harsh way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, them nuns treated me like a human being. She was very poor. She couldn't afford to buy lunch. She would steal, actually, to be able to eat. So the nuns, knowing that and knowing she had a strong sense of pride, would give her little chores to do and reward her by feeding her. And it was for a short while, but she never, ever forgot it.
Wow. You've been an actor for quite a while.
Yes.
Number of decades.
Yes.
And yet, when it came to Ethel Waters, you decided it was time to become a playwright. Why did you decide to take on the life of Ethel Waters, to write it yourself?
Well, let me tell you, when I started out, I had no intention of writing it. All I did was the research. And I figured one day, somehow, the universe and I bring me someone who could write. And I approached, some people did talk about, has expressed an interest in it, and I actually asked one person who I had worked with to do it. He said he was interested, and then we just couldn't seem to get together. Then in 2010, this little voice spoke to me. Not voices. I'm not schizophrenic. Just voices. Just one little voice. And it speaks to me every once in a while when there's something significant in my life. And it said, if you don't do this and do it now, it will never be done. So I did write a script, and it stunk. And my friend Loretta Devine was here doing The Colored Girls. And I read the script to her, the stinky script. And she said to me, why? I think I had her, with some testimonial dinner that the Billy Graham people and she said, why are you writing it like that? She said, I'm middle-aged and I still think I'm sexy. But here's the significance. I'm watching her and I'm listening her talk to me. And everybody knows who Loretta Devine is. She's a big star, but she was my friend. And she was very relaxed with me. You see, if she were saying this and she was on Bill Nygut's show or some television show, she would have been a lot more careful about the way she parsed her words. But she was very relaxed in the way she spoke to me. And I thought, oh my God, what if Ethel could talk about the things, whatever she wanted to talk about, and do it that way.
Yeah.
Do it knowing that no matter what she said or how she said it, that it would be okay. Because the people she were talking to or the person she's talking to loves her, respects her, and even if they're titillated or out or scandalized by what she's saying, it's okay. And so once I had that hook, because that was the hook, I couldn't stop writing. And so I began to, I sent it to a couple of friends, and they said, you know what, you got something here.
My guest today is Terry Burrell. She's about to open at the Alliance Theater in a one-woman show called Ethel. She wrote it herself about the life of the stage, screen, and television star Ethel Waters. We'll have more of our conversation after a break. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm talking today to Broadway singer and actress Terry Burrell. She's about to open at the Alliance Theater in a one-woman show called Ethel, a show that Terry also wrote. It's the story of Ethel Waters, one of the first great black stars of modern show business.
And it was held out at the new hall.
all the bootleggers in the town.
That's the first record that Waters recorded in 1921. She made it for Black Swan Records, the first major African-American owned and operated record company. The song was called At the New Jump Steady Ball.
Everybody in the hall was so they started serving me wine and wine, and everything it was alcohol night.
From those early beginnings, Waters went on to have a stellar career. She was one of the few stars who was able to break racial barriers that separated black performers from the mainstream entertainment business. So it's not surprising that Terry Burrell would find the life of Waters fascinating and at least in some ways inspiring. So, do you remember when you became aware of Ethel Waters? Did you, when you were growing up, did you know who Ethel Waters was? Did she have an impact on you in any way? Or, as you started your own career when you were a little older, I'm going to guess that there probably were times when you faced challenges as an African-American actor. And I wonder if Ethel Waters had, in her life and the way she became strong and bold, mattered to you in some way.
Well, I can't pinpoint when I became aware of her. I think she was sort of always around. But when I did Bubbling Brown Sugar, which was my first professional touring show, I worked with people like Charles Honey Coles and J. Flash Riley. These people went way back, you know, when Cotton Club was in its heyday. And that's when I began to hear stories of her. And luckily, I was able to interview Mr. Coles before he passed away. And
tell people who he was.
Charles Honey Coles was what they called a hoofer. He was a tap dancer, and he was around when the Nicholas Brothers were around. Yeah. And all these people, him, Mabel Lee and these people, they played at the Apollo. And they did like 9, 12 shows a day. And you didn't get an hour and a half in between shows, you know, equity rules. You went out on the fire escape, bought a chicken dinner, and ate it, and went out on the stage. So it wasn't until 1990 that I was looking for something to do. I had a sense. I just had this intuitive sense that I was going to need something. And my friend Michael Leslie, who is an amazing performer, was at my apartment, and he said, you know what you should do? You should do Ethel Waters, because she is in danger of being forgotten. And at first, I couldn't find her autobiography, His Eyes on the Sparrow. And finally, I did. A lot of the material that I use in the piece comes from that book, and as well as personal stories that were told to me. And, of course, the only time it could have been written was in 2010, because life had happened to me. Life. And
what does that mean?
Well, you know, a lot of what Ethel's life is about loss. And I understood loss in a very personal way. I lost my mother. I lost my father, you know. And I was getting older, and things were beginning to change in the business. I've been fortunate that I've been able to continue to work, but it isn't like when I was 30 years old. Yes, you better believe I've had challenges being an African-American actor. I mean, in New York City alone, there were shows that you couldn't even audition for. Don't even bother, because there were no African-Americans.
In the 70s? 60s?
I'm talking about the 80s.
The 80s?
Yeah. The 80s, that's about when I was...
That's kind of stunning, Terry.
It is stunning. It is stunning. And there were times when I was very frustrated because I'm thinking, we're just a few short years away from the 21st century. Why are we still dealing with this stupidity? Look, you know, most people will ask actors, why do you think, you know, there aren't more African Americans? Well, you know, don't ask us. I think... In all fairness, people, I think, get scared, and they think that maybe if they do it too much that, you know, audiences are going to reject that. But, you know, all I got to say now is, like, look at Hamilton, you know.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, and I hope that heralds a new day. And I really think that the industry tries to do the best that they can. I really do. And certainly I've been able to be in shows where I play roles that would be considered non-traditional casting. You know, that more happens in regional theater than it does on Broadway, but...
I'm thinking about a couple of examples. I think I'm right that you played Andy Eller at the arena? No, at the arena
Ann
stage?
Eller, yeah.
Ann
at
Eller
arena stage.
From Oklahoma.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rarely cast to have a black woman playing Ann Eller.
Absolutely. And that was a very mixed cast. And then, of course, they did Into the Woods here at the Alliance. That was very mixed. And I did it on Broadway. I played one of the stepsisters. And I was able to, I was standing by a Thoroughly Modern Millie. And I was covering Muzzy, and I was covering Mrs. Mears, where Harriet Harris had won the Tony for it. And there came that night when the stage manager said, you're going to have to go on as Mrs. Mears. And, you know, under all that makeup, nobody can tell who was playing it. And the director, Michael Mayer, came backstage and said, you know what, you should feel very proud. And from now on, you're going on as Mrs. Mears. And it was great because I'd leave stage and nobody knew who I was.
How many songs do you sing of hers in
the show? About 15 songs.
Wow. Okay. And are you trying to channel her voice? Have you listened and studied? Or are you trying to bring your own interpretation to her songs?
I don't try to bring my own interpretation, and I don't mimic her, but I do try to catch certain vocal inflections, especially His Eyes on the Sparrow.
Yeah.
And that's a really important moment, because that's the moment when she eulogizes her grandmother.
What do you imagine she'd be thinking if she were looking down watching you do her in this show?
Well, I'm sure she'd have a few suggestions. But I think that she would be supportive and very loving. You know, one of the people that I spoke to for 2 hours at length was Leslie Uggams, because Ethel Waters mentored her when she was a little girl, between the ages of 6 and 9. She was very, very kind. She loved children. She could not have any children of her own and didn't have any children of her own. She raised a couple of kids, you know, once when she had a pianist by the name of Pearl, and Pearl had gotten very ill, and she raised her daughter until Pearl got well enough. And I think there was a great niece that she reared for a short time. But she was very kind to Leslie. So when I asked Leslie questions, she would say to me, now remember, I'm going to tell you from the perspective of that 6 to 9 year old.
Right.
But she was able to give me some very pertinent information.
Earlier in your career, did you call yourself Teresa?
You know what? I called myself Terry, but I was a young, spiffy little thing. It was actually a someone who was, I was going for a television or a radio interview or something, and she said to me, now remember to wear something pretty now and do your hair. And I thought, who is she? Does she think she's talking to like a 12-year-old? And listen, when you say a name, there's a certain vibration to it. And I think because my personality has always been very bubbly, and then young, I always look younger than my age. And she felt the need to tell me something like that. And I said, I'm going to start calling myself Teresa, which is my legal name, because when people hear it, it'll vibrate differently. It'll sound more mature.
So put on your headphones, please. Let's go back to a June night in 1985 as a way to talk about your career on Broadway. Let's listen to this.
I'm Loretta Devine.
I'm Deborah Burrell.
I'm Teresa Burrell.
And we're so happy to be working on Broadway in Dreamgirls.
Well, Teresa Burrell, there you were, the Broadway cast. What a thrill. I mean, first of all, working in Dreamgirls on Broadway, but then to get to present at the Tony Awards.
And working with my sister.
And I was,
as a matter of fact, I replaced my sister. She was the original Michelle, who's the girl who replaces the character that Jennifer Holliday played. She went on tour because she and Jennifer were very, very close. The last 2 months of the Broadway production that I did, because it came back a few years later, they brought my sister in, and she played Dina, and I played Michelle. So when you go to the Lincoln Center, if you ever go to the Lincoln Center and look at it on the archives, you'll see me and my beautiful sister, Debbie.
Your first Broadway show was Eubie?
It was Eubie, and I actually met Eubie Blake, and I do, and he is in the show, and it's a story. I have a friend by the name of Vince Giordano, who has a band called Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks, and I've sung with them a couple of times, and he told me this outrageous story, but if you want to know what it is, you're just going to have to come and see the show.
So did you grow up watching Broadway theater? Were you able to go see theater when you were a kid?
You know, I really didn't.
Okay.
But I always sang, and I was in all kinds of shows and contests and blah, blah, blah. But I remember going to see a Broadway show. I was still, you know, I don't even think I was 20 years old yet, but I looked at the show, and I looked at the people on the stage, and I said, I can do that.
That's why I wanted to ask you. It seems to me that almost every actor, and in fact, people who have never been actors but love theater, have at least one show that they sat in that audience and looked at the stage, and suddenly it the energy, the electricity, it lit them up. That's true
right.
for you?
That's right. I think the show was Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope. And I ended up becoming friends with many of those cast members.
Tell me how you've done so much great work. What is Ethel, as you're preparing to do this show, how do you see what it says about your career and how it's brought you to this moment?
Well, I think now that I have perspective that you've got to read the tea leaves and smell the wind a little bit. And we all want to be on stage and be the star, but sometimes you can be a star doing other things. I would love to explore this thing called writing, whether it's playwriting, whether it's writing a novel, whatever. Look, I love to tell stories. I'm a storyteller. That's what I do the best. And that's what I would like to continue to do, whether I do it in plays, whether I turn this Ethel thing into a concert form, which I have done in the past. I love to entertain and leave a message and do things that create conversation. This piece, if nothing else, will create conversation. It will explore many things. The whole idea of aging. You know, when you're aging, you don't see yourself like other people see you. You know, her career could have been over at 52, but she was still 30 in her mind. She could still do it. We're all like that. But she was dismissed and made to feel invisible. We all have been victims of that as we age. We talk about racism, you know, which was, I would love to say that it has changed and has become better. And I think in many instances it has, but that ugly thing is still there. And we've never had a really intelligent conversation about it in this country. It becomes too emotional. But in the meantime, look, in the end, here's the thing, Bill. I'm at the stage in my life where what I want to do more than anything else is grow in consciousness, to live a conscious life. And this piece allows me to be conscious, to leave my little light in the world. This piece is not about tragedy and sadness and horror. It isn't that. And she doesn't tell it that way. In even as horrible, as tragic as some of the things are, she finds humor in it. And you know you do that. You could talk about the most horrible thing that ever happened to you. I've spoken to people who've been in a hospital, and the way they talk about it, you're on the floor dying with laughter. That's what I want to do. What anybody takes from it is theirs. I have nothing to do with that part. Most people that remember her, that are around, kind of remember her from that time. And I felt it was important to show the complexity of this woman, or at least, attempt to show the complexity of her personality, because she was not this grandmotherly, mammy kind of figure. We all wear masks to some degree. Nobody knows what happened in your household this morning before you came here to the radio station. But sometimes there's just a friend, somebody, or a group of people who you can just let that mask slip with, just a little bit. And you give them just a little peek behind that mask. Nobody better than celebrities. Nobody's better at hiding behind a mask than celebrities are. So this is what she does in the course of the evening. The audience becomes her confidant. And she just lets that mask slip. Just enough to give her some relief, to allow her to talk about some things that are really painful or private to her. And sometimes she says it in a way that's very naughty, you know, that might be a little challenging for some people in the audience to hear, but never enough so that it overwhelms anybody. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, this is what it is. This was my life. So what do you want me to say?
It's a real pleasure, Terry Burrell, to watch the way you light up as you talk just now about writing and then performing this one-woman show, Ethel, the story of Ethel Waters. Thank you so much for being here, Terry. It's really a pleasure to get to talk to you today.
Thank you.
I've been talking with actress and singer Terry Burrell about her one-woman show, Ethel. It looks at the life of Ethel Waters. The show opens at the Alliance Theater on Friday, March 25th. The song His Eye Is on the Sparrow that Ethel Waters became so closely associated with in the later years of her career has a strong connection to Georgia. Waters was cast in the Broadway production of the stage play The Member of the Wedding. It opened in New York in January of 1950. The play was based on a novella written by Columbus, Georgia native Carson McCullers. She adapted it herself for the stage. McCullers often wrote about the deep melancholy and sense of isolation that afflicted outcasts and misfits living in small towns in Georgia. In The Member of the Wedding, the misfit is Frankie Adams, a 12-year-old tomboy who feels disconnected from the world around her. Her only comfort comes from her close ties to the family's black housekeeper, Bernice. McCullers talked about adapting Member of the Wedding in a filmed interview she gave several years after it had become a major hit.
Actually, A Member of the Wedding was written originally in book form, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a book, and I adopted it myself for the theater.
That probably was a job in itself all by itself.
It was lots of fun, as a matter of fact. I'd never worked with people before, and just the mechanics of getting together on production is something fascinating to me.
Well, not delving too deeply into social problems, it has a very important message, doesn't it?
Well, I hadn't thought about it in terms of social problems. Just, I always think more about it in terms of human beings, and it's just the theme, the basic theme is just the need to belong.
To belong to someone, to belong to a...
To belong to something, to feel oneself a part of life.
The housekeeper, Bernice, was a part tailor-made for Waters. And in fact, she got billing above the title in that original Broadway production. She may have had some influence on one aspect of the play. The story goes that during an early reading, Waters asked McCullers about a song that her character was to sing to Frankie and her brother in a moment when they both needed comforting. Apparently, the original song McCullers had in mind was a lullaby that Waters believed a black woman would never have thought to sing. So she proposed the song she'd sung so often to comfort her grandmother, His Eye Is on the Sparrow. Waters sang it for McCullers and the assembled production team, and according to Broadway lore, McCullers was so moved she crossed the room to embrace Waters tearfully. That scene became one of the most powerful and touching in both the stage production and in the 1952 movie, which featured the same cast, Ethel Waters as Bernice, a young Julie Harris as Frankie, and the unknown child actor Brandon DeWilde, who would go on to fame in the movie Shane. As the scene starts, Waters and the children are huddling close together. She has her arms around them, and DeWilde idly starts singing the song their housekeeper sang to them so often. Waters picks it up.
I sing because I'm happy. I sing because I'm free. For his eye is on the sparrow. And I know he watches.
from heaven and home.
I suspect that the story of the member of the wedding may have moved Waters deeply. In the opening lines of her autobiography, which she called His Eye Is on the Sparrow, she writes, "I was never a child. I was never coddled or liked or understood by my family. I never felt I belonged. I was always an outsider." Despite the fact that she became one of the great stars of show business, Ethel Waters never did feel that she belonged, which just reminds us we can never really know the joys and heartaches of the famous people we admire. Carson McCullers would have understood that, because with all her acclaim, she too always felt like an outsider who never quite fit in. And maybe it was just those feelings of longing to belong that made both Waters and McCullers such important artists. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'll have some thoughts about a milestone we're celebrating here on Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. Like a lot of people in my advanced baby boomer age group, I'm getting more and more nervous about just how quickly time is flowing past me. Wasn't it just last week that my wife and I settled our 19-year-old daughter Emma in her college dorm? Apparently not, because Emma's just a matter of weeks from finishing her freshman year in college. Wasn't it just a few short months ago that my beard was black and my hair was thick on my head? No, that was the me of more than a decade ago. On the brighter side, the year I had to wait for the new season of The Americans to start again last week just seemed to fly by. And then there's this. The other day, someone who keeps track of these things better than I do pointed out that this week we're presenting the 100th episode of Two Way Street. Our first show was broadcast on July 5th, 2014. And at the time, I really had no idea whether we'd make it as a regular part of the GPB radio schedule or not. But we have. 100 episodes later, I continue to feel great joy in getting to have extended conversations with the remarkable people who walk into the Two Way Street studios. Authors, scientists, chefs, public health heroes, musicians, artists, and thought leaders, all of whom have fascinating stories to tell. As we begin production on show 101, I'm grateful for a number of things. To you, first of all, listeners who've sent me notes, emails, tweets, and Facebook posts saying how much you like the program we're doing. That makes me happier than you'll ever know. Second, I found a producer in Jenny Amond who is already making Two Way Street sound better every week. And finally, I'm grateful to the GPB radio team. Radio Vice President Tanya Ott, News Director Eric Burns, Operations Director Tom Barclay, Vice President of Marketing and Promotion Bert Huffman, and our forward-thinking leader, President of GPB Taya Ryan. Let's do 100 more, and 100 after that. That's all the time we have for this week's show. We're going to post on the Two Way Street Facebook page and on the gpbnews.org website added content related to this week's show. You'll find a link to the scene from The Member of the Wedding where Ethel Waters sings His Eye on the Sparrow, and a link to the wonderful short-filmed interview with Carson McCullers you heard an excerpt from today. Remember that you can listen to Two Way Street on your own schedule by downloading our podcast from iTunes or your favorite podcast provider. You can also stream the show by going to the gpbnews.org website. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us today. I hope to see you again next week for episode 101 of Two Way Street.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I've been out till